one thing which was characteristic of the so-called old Russian school was the rather flat fingers. The point of the flat finger was that it produced a better sound.
To the first note, and it's a single rotation to the two, double to three, single from three to one.
The fingertip supports the weight. That's why the fingers need to be very strong. We want the weight that we're using from our mechanism.
The fourth thing on a black key to go to a thumb, if you have it an octave distance, is atrocious. The small amount of twisting that that fourth finger creates, I would guess that half the pianists who are injured and crippled do so because they're using the fourth finger on the black key. I find that's one of the most common causes of injury. You've already broken the hand off from the arm, and one of the most important elements of a fine technique is the fact that...
That's really the whole story of technique. That when we move to the, when we move up and to the left, everything moves together. You see, all the fingers are lifted together. When we swing back, everything...
Pianists devote years to developing a spotless technique. By weeding out imprecision in the touch and unevenness in passage work, students in piano build dexterity, velocity, and control. In fact, ever since being a keyboardist was considered a specialized skill, there were practitioners of how to develop that spotless, healthy technique. As you've just heard in the prior amalgamation, injury prevention became an important and lucrative part of piano teaching, complete with different schools of thought on the matter. The only catch? What happens when a composer refuses to go along with the well-intended practitioners of pain-free technique?
I'm Maria Sisnik. I'm an associate professor in the Humanities and Cultural Studies Department at the University of South Florida. I wrote a book called Performing Pain, Music and Trauma in Eastern Europe. Yeah, there's something really satisfying about playing music that sort of violates your training and conventions. I guess you have to be a certain kind of person or performer to sort of enjoy that, but there is something just really satisfying to make a lot of noise. And there's something really satisfying about kind of that, like ramping up that physical relationship with the piano and like the kind of force. Every teacher, at least my childhood teacher, would be very unhappy with me sort of like belly flopping onto the piano with my hands.
I'm of the opinion that the role of the musician is to seek to achieve the sort of sound a composer had in his or her head at the time of conception. As I've mentioned in a previous episode, musical notation can only get us so far when it comes to understanding that original idea, but it can certainly help, especially in late 20th century music, when styles became so individualized and certain sounds became so novel. Throughout her piano works, the Soviet composer Galina Usvolskaya gives numerous written instructions on the technique she sees fit to achieve such characteristic sounds. It's not uncommon to see instructions such as, strike the keys with the knuckles of the left hand, forefingers curved, thumb protruding at an angle, and ensure these strikes are clearly audible. In other passages, such as throughout the sixth piano sonata, which you're hearing now, she indicates each tone cluster should be struck with the edge of the hand, the flattened palm, or the forearm. I spoke with a number of other musicians about the relationships between this expansion of technique, its potential for pain, its overall physicality, and how it affects the overall affect of a piece of music.
My name is Tom Curry. I am the tuba and euphonium professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
My name is Eva Ugarčić, and I am the founder and executive director of Lunar Art Festival and artistic director of Rural Musicians Forum.
I'm Satoko Hayami. I'm a collaborative pianist living in Madison from Japan.
The three performed Galina Usvolskaya's Composition No. 1 for tuba, piccolo, and piano in summer of 2018. We'll hear a performance of that work at the close of this episode. But first, here's a bit of my discussion with them.
In the latter half of the 20th century, there were kind of these artistic movements that seemed to idealize art that confronted people. So you have the abstract expressionists. Part of the art was the violence of creating it, the technique of creating it. So not only did the technique of creating visual art become more violent, but performance art became popular. It became just as much about people's reactions, about the reception of the art, as it did the work in itself. So there's several ways that I was thinking Usvolskaya's music falls into this. It's confrontational in that it's a sustained dissonance that people are subjected to, something that doesn't let up in intensity. It's confronting audiences with silence, which generally makes people uncomfortable. And then it also confronts musicians with techniques that they wouldn't normally use, like sustained notes that are super, super loud or soft. Piano music in particular, there's one piano sonata where she wants clusters, but she wants them played with the knuckles of the hand, and she wants you to actually knock on the keys. She wants the actual sound of the knocking as well as the sound of the strings. Whether audience or performer, I feel like the music hurts on some level. So I wonder if you all could comment on any of those ideas.
Well, I remember Satoko, and I don't know, just tell me if I'm wrong, but I remember that you were saying when we were rehearsing, you were like, it's not that it hurts only emotionally, but it hurts physically to play piano, right? So I think you can talk about that, actually, and how it's like physically, like, it's hurting. It's like, were you the one that said that it's actually hurting your, or you?
I think maybe I said that too.
I think I remember when we were rehearsing, you were like, that it hurts physically. It hurts
like yeah, if I play it louder than I am right now, it's going to hurt. But then I feel like it that's what's written on the score.
Yeah.
I guess she wanted you to feel the pain.
For the tuba player, it's not necessarily painful, but you know it's going to be uncomfortable. And part of the physical preparation for the piece is dealing with that discomfort, dealing with having to move massive amounts of air in a way that is going to put you in a position where you're going to feel uncomfortable. I'm not sure if there's a better word for that. It's uncomfortable to play this piece.
It's extreme.
So you have to recognize that going in, and you have to prepare for it. And that's part of the performance. For me, it's not, okay, how can I get through this and it's going to be a breeze? It's about going into that extreme and about navigating your way through it. And if that means it's a little less precise, that's fine, because that's the piece. You know it's intentional. There's no way she wrote what she did for it to feel great while you play it. There's no way she wrote what she did for you to feel great when you listen to it. I had the sort of intimate experience with this piece of editing and mixing for a recording that I did for hours, sitting there with headphones on, listening to this piece over and over and over and over again. It hurt. And it definitely damaged hearing. It just did. And there's no way around it. So to think of a composer, a meticulous composer, like it's clear that she is. There's just no way she wrote that without it meaning to be extreme and to be uncomfortable and to be painful physically.
Yeah.
My mindset before going into the performance that we did at Lunart was that, I don't know if everyone does this, but I have to get in the zone, you know, like just to be in the same mindset as the piece requires. So for me, the mindset I was going for was, I don't feel the pain, you know, I don't feel the pain and I want to, you know, that kind of thing. Like,
you want to.
like I wanted to, like, right? Like, because like, I have to go.
Like, you need it, basically. You almost, like, need it.
Yeah, but yeah. You have to go for it, right? Yeah. Like, you gotta go hit the notes as hard as you can, and you're gonna feel the pain, but then you have to keep doing that until the piece ends. So, like, the mindset was, like, I want to attack as hard as I could. Like, that, like, it doesn't matter, it hurts, it just, like, have to. Yeah, and
that's honestly the sensation that I got when I did the 6th piano sonata, almost to the point of wanting the audience to be hurt. Absolutely. By the sound I was making.
Well, I would also say that the experience that you're talking about requires a special musician, especially right now where I think there's a lot of attention being paid to injuries in musicians and doing things the right way and having the correct posture and doing things sustainably, and rightly so. There are a lot of musicians who would look at something that's meant to be painful to the performer and just say, why would a composer ever do that?
Mm, yeah,
you
know,
right,
that's
away.
Almost disrespectful to the musician, because, you know, you have this career and to do something that hurts or to do something that could potentially cause an injury is wrong. Useful Skies music really requires that you throw that to the side, at least for a little bit, and just say, no, I'm going in, and it might not end well, but that's the way it's got to be. Otherwise, it's not the piece.
So Maria, in your book Performing Pain, you mentioned this term hesychasm, and I'm unfamiliar with that word, but you say hesychasm emphasizes the positive role of suffering in the life of the believer. I wonder if you can give a couple of brief examples of how, in the Soviet context, suffering and pain can be equated with truth.
With truth, yeah. Well, that hesychasm is kind of the monastic tradition of the Orthodox Christian tradition, and there is a way in which, right, that it kind of takes the idea of Christ's suffering and then translates that into a way of conceiving pain in a person's life as having ultimately like a kind of positive experience. So you have this kind of like a kind of Russian cultural sort of idea of these various kind of redemptive roles that pain can play. And I think like in the Soviet context, there is a way in which I think drawing attention, really attending to the kind of reality of the pain and consequences of violence was very much tied to truth. Mm.
You also write that Usfulskaya's advocates endow her life and compositions with a kind of sacralized suffering, moral and aesthetic authority. So we know that historians are still uncovering the degree to the death and poverty and starvation and fear that took place in the Soviet Union. But this way that she was talked about by the people around her seems to tell us that this music, both in sound and also just what it takes to perform it, it's quite an accurate portrayal of the society. So I guess the physicality involved in creating such sound is a kind of sublimation of suffering.
The first part of the kind of way in which her former students and friends kind of have talked about her, that, you know, you may be in this repressive regime, but artists and intellectuals who find a kind of internal creative space in which they can experience freedom and write and create what they want to. It may not reach a public, or it may reach only a very small public. The important thing was to do this act of creativity on one's own terms. There's a kind of stakes of like authenticity and integrity in that, as well as a kind of ethical stance, like you're being truthful and truthful to yourself. When you look at kind of the reception of Ustvolskaya by her people who knew her, who were close to her at the time when she was alive, they kind of draw on that sort of trope that she was true to herself, and that truth to herself had this kind of stakes of integrity. And yeah, maybe her music wasn't for a mainstream audience or for the official composers union, but she had integrity. It has value for those reasons.
Well, I'd like to give a special word of thanks to my guests this episode, Eva Ugruchik, Tom Curry, and Satoko Hayami. I'm also extremely grateful to Maria Sismic for taking the time to speak with me from Florida about her research around music from the late Soviet Union, trauma theory, and embodiments of pain. I'll be featuring more from that discussion in an upcoming episode, but her book, Performing Pain, Music and Trauma in Eastern Europe, was published in 2011 by Oxford University Press. If you're interested in a similar podcast to this, I recommend Flute 360 with Heidi K. Begay. I can honestly say that I've gotten so much from her podcast, even though technically it's a flute podcast. She has on a number of living composers, as well as musicians who are doing interesting things with their craft. Thanks again, and enjoy a portion of Galina Usfolskaya's Composition No. 1 for tuba, piccolo, and piano. Yeah.
Okay.